Moving Iron Podcast is proud to be part of the Global Ag Network. The network is live, so check out globalagnetwork.com for more details and updates. Now on to the show.
Moving Iron in the 21st century. Hardworking people working hard for you and me. Moving Iron time and time again.
Hello and welcome to Moving Iron Podcast number 133 with my guest Tanner Emke. Tanner, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Casey. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Well, Tanner's a repeat guest. I think you've had him on here at least three times for sure. And if not fourth, this might be the fifth time I've had you on here, Tanner. But Tanner works for CoBank, and he is part of their knowledge exchange group. And basically, Tanner's job is to watch the economic conditions of the market for CoBank and how that is going to affect the overall economic kind of output of the ag market through the coming year. So, Tanner, welcome to the show again, man.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Casey.
All right, Tanner. I wish I had you on a time when there wasn't as much to talk about, but we got plenty to talk about today. So, first off, I want to touch on, I hate talking about China trade. I'm kind of over it. We've talked about it for a million times, and it's just like one day it's going to be, the best thing ever, and then nothing ever happens, and then they go back to the drawing board, or they get mad at each other, or whatever it is, and they move on. But there's supposed to be another round of talks coming up next week. It does sound like the U.S. and China are very, very close to getting something done. And, you look at what's going on and how that's going to affect everything. I'm kind of to the opinion now that, China, the trade deficit that we have with China, or the trade deficit, the trade situation that we're dealing with China right now, does have an effect on the market, but I almost wonder if it never happened, if we wouldn't still be in a similar boat. So what are your thoughts on that, and then what would it mean to the overall economy if tomorrow we woke up and China and the U.S. signed a deal and we were back to being best friends again?
Well, obviously, any end to the trade war would be a positive, because there is no such thing as a good trade war, Casey.
Right.
And when you operate from that assumption, the sooner we get over with this trade war, the better.
Right.
The problem is, how lasting would a deal be? Because for better or for worse, there was a deadline back in March 1st that we would end the trade war, which we didn't. And it would have been great if we did back in March. So we've got a history now that deadlines don't matter. And so there is some concern among some economists that they're very doubtful that we'll have a conclusion to the trade war. In fact, they think it will continue to persist on some level throughout the duration of the Trump administration, whether that's another 2 years or another 4 years. On some level, there will be trade protectionism for sure. And so the concern is what level of trade hostility will we have with China? And that doesn't end, but at what level will it persist? But that being said, if we can go back to where we were prior, elimination of the tariffs that we had on the steel and aluminum imports, and then their retaliatory tariffs were lifted, that would be a fantastic move forward for sure. And we need that deal done. The U.S. would benefit substantially by having that deal done sooner rather than later. But there's a whole lot of things going on with this trade war, Casey, that really raises some questions over what concessions will be made, how beneficial will it be for the U.S., and how long-lasting will it be. We've already suffered some deterioration of our market share in China, and a lot of those trading channels have moved to other suppliers. Soybeans, obviously, have been sourced out of other locations, like South America. Some coming in from places like Russia, even. Other oil seeds, anyway. And so once those trade routes have been reestablished, it's a really hard thing to get those trade routes back, especially if a trade war persists over a longer time. It becomes more and more difficult to get those markets back. So any resolution that we get to end the trade war and the lifting of those tariffs and the lifting of the retaliatory tariffs specifically, that is going to be a positive for U.S. agricultural markets. And ultimately, that would be a positive for U.S. farmers. So the way I understand the trade war as it stands right now, let's make some distinction first, Casey. This is not a formal trade agreement like, say, for instance, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was a formal agreement inked by a number of countries and passed by their respective legislative bodies. That's formal. All those terms are in ink about how they're going to be enforced, how things are going to be monitored, all that stuff is made official. There's really nothing official in the deal with China. This is more like a temporary ceasefire if we got a deal. If Trump and Xi Jinping were to ink out a deal here soon, it's not a formal agreement, because a formal agreement has to pass through Congress. Congress has to vote on it and agree to it, and so does the legislative body over in China, and then it becomes formalized. Well, that doesn't exist here. There's no formalized enforcement mechanism that's in place and transparent for everybody to understand that if we go back to doing XYZ, well, we will suffer ABC punishment, so to speak. All that stuff would be lined out in writing and clear for everybody to understand. That's not here. So whatever we get in this agreement, what comes after it? Well, the markets will respond favorably, but there's always going to be that concern that we can easily go back to it because Trump imposed the tariffs unilaterally. Specifically, we're talking about the steel and aluminum tariffs, and then all the subsequent tariffs that followed as the trade war escalated. And so that could happen again. There's nothing really formalizing what would not allow that. Or what would happen if China reneged on the agreement with Trump. So there's always that concern that really how permanent is this agreement if we were to have one. The other thing, Casey, is that the markets have been anticipating a negotiation with China for quite some time. The Chinese have committed to buying a number of U.S. products, namely pork, soybeans, natural gas, so they can help narrow the bilateral trade deficit between the U.S. and China. Well, that's all well and good. Those are beneficial sales. Those sales are beneficial for the U.S. Those were in good faith to help move these negotiations forward. But really, Casey, China was going to buy those products anyway. So how much of a change in the relationship have we had so far? If that's any hint of what we're going to, what kind of negotiation or what kind of resolution to this trade war we're going to have in a negotiation between Trump and Xi Jinping, then that would suggest that an agreement is not going to be materially or substantially different than the relationship we had prior. So that's of concern. Trade war really going to get us anything? So there's a lot of head scratching about what is really going to change. The other thing is because this is a non-formalized agreement, because it's more of like a memorandum of understanding or an MOU between Trump and Xi Jinping, that as soon as Trump leaves office, all bets are off. There's no guarantee that that China is not going to go back to their old ways of what they know how to do very well, which is to steal from other countries and pirate, and to steal their technology. So I'm a little on the fence about what negotiation really means. I think a lot of economists are very hopeful that something would happen, in terms of finding better ways to do business with China, especially with intellectual property rights and forced technology transfer. But long term, it's a real question mark of how anything would be enforced and how to keep this agreement in place. There's really no indication that it could be.
My other question is, okay, so we've got this stuff going off the trade thing, and just like you talked about, it's just more of a gentleman's agreement, I mean, for lack of a better term, that's going on here. It could get inked, it could get voted on between the two governments, and they could come together and actually have something come out of this. Do you think that there's a possibility that it could just be that, hey, we'll just agree on this together and, we'll see what happens down the road? Do you think it's heading that way, or do you feel like there could be some, binding agreement between the two countries?
Well, what Trump wants most is to show that he has a win heading into the 2020 election. And now that, you're just here recently, Joe Biden entered the race for the Democratic as one of the many Democratic nominees for president that's going to run against Trump. Mm-hmm. Trump wants to show that he has a win, that he has progress. And so there's motivation there to show that things have changed with China. And probably for the next, for sure, the next year or so, China's going to try to make good on whatever negotiations were made. They're going to buy a lot of stuff from the United States. But is that something that is that will that momentum fade after the first year? A lot of people are thinking this is again really not something that's going to be going to change the relationship materially between the U.S. and China. And in fact, when it comes to the agricultural exports, we may actually end up in a losing position because, as I mentioned earlier. Once those other export channels have been established, it's hard to get them back. Even after we've inked a deal with China, you've got buyers over in China that have already established new relationships. And other areas of the world have increased their acreage. And so what's the point of going back to the United States when you've got a more diversified market to buy from? So there's going to be more soybeans out of Argentina and Brazil. There's going to be more canola that you can get out of Canada, perhaps. There's more oil seeds you can get out of the former Soviet Union or the Black Sea region. So even if we get something, even if Trump and Xi come to an agreement, those export channels are already in place. So again, trying to figure out what will happen long term, I mean, that's always going to be a problem. But here in the short term, we can definitely say the U.S. will benefit from a conclusion to the trade war. But are we going to go back to where we were before? It's not looking like we will. It's looking like we lost market share over in China.
Now, losing market share is never a never a good thing, and that is for sure. But with the Asian swine fever that's going on over there, I mean, how much are we going to benefit from that? I mean, I look at that and there's a lot of stuff going there. I mean, yeah, you can get a lot of pigs back in production pretty quick just because of their gestation cycles and how many piglets they have in every litter and those kind of things. But that does open the door to a lot of different stuff, whether it be beef or poultry or fish or whatever it might be. Do you feel like there could be some just gain there anyway, just because of the situation they're in?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you brought up a very good point. African swine fever changes the game in many, many, many big ways. We'll see what happens with African swine fever, but just to recap on what's happening there, the Chinese government has announced that said about 21% of their sow population has been lost because of African swine fever. There's no vaccine for this virus. There's no way to cure it. The only way to stop it is to cull herds or to quarantine a farm, and then all the pigs have to be eliminated. You know, they get bulldozed into a pit. And so it's a pretty serious situation over in China. And fortunately, the virus, it only affects hogs. It doesn't affect beef. It doesn't affect birds or cattle or anything like that. It only affects hogs. But half of the world's hogs are in China. So when 20% of their hog herd or their sow herd disappears, that has huge implications on the world pork market. And then by extension, to backfill that demand for pork in lieu of that pork supply that has disappeared, that's going to take a lot, that could potentially take a lot of poultry and beef. So the U.S. stands as it right now to benefit substantially from African swine fever running rampant in China. And so in that case, personally, any deal that the Chinese ink with the United States here coming up to end this trade war would almost not necessarily be that important anymore, because they're going to have to buy from us anyway. For agricultural products, anyway. And so, just to put it in context, you know, the reduction in their hog population would more than exceed the total exportable pork supplies in the entire world.
Right.
So, just put that into context here. Mm-hmm. If all of the world's pork exports went to China to fill that gap, it still wouldn't be enough.
Right.
And so you've got this huge hole of animal protein demand that would need to be filled by competing proteins, namely beef and poultry. So we, pork producers right now are benefiting quite well because of this. We've had a huge spike in lean hog futures on the Chicago Board, the CME. And so pork producers right now are doing very well. They're inking some pretty good profits. Now, here's the other side of this argument that we have to be very careful of. What if African swine fever came to the United States? Now, that would be disastrous on so many levels. It's hard to fathom, because right now in the United States, we've got overcapacity of production and processing for animal protein. This is across the entire sector. I mean, we're talking about pork and chicken and beef. Now, if we had African swine fever coming to the United States, our export program disappears immediately. I mean, it's lights off, because, or lights out rather, because nobody wants to import that virus into their country. So in order to protect themselves, they're going to have to cancel all of their pork orders or all of their orders of pork or pork-related products from the United States. It'd be like the BSE outbreak back in, what was it, 2003, mm-hmm. when we had mad cow disease, as it's called, or BSE, yep. Was found in the United States, came in from Canada. The beef export market disappeared instantly, because all these countries need to protect themselves. So if we have African swine fever come to the United States, we lose all of our export business. And right now, 26% of the market for pork is overseas for us. And so you take 26% of our production and try to force that onto the consumer here in the United States, the U.S. consumer just can't eat that much pork. And so what's going to happen, you're going to have a lot of culling of herds. You're going to have a lot of farmers that expanded who are now going to have they're going to have pork they can't send anywhere. The U.S. market will be absolutely saturated, and it'll take time in order for those embargoes to be lifted, or for those export, for those bans to be lifted, and for us to regain those export markets. So that's on the other side of African swine fevers if it came to the United States. It's not, obviously it's not here right now. It's only out. It's only in China, or excuse me, Asia at large, and in Europe, places like that. So right now we're okay, and we're benefiting from that. And U.S. farmer pork producers are doing very well because of it. Hopefully, it stays that way. Yeah. But back to the trade negotiation and the point you were making earlier, you're absolutely right. This is a game changer, and the Chinese would probably lift their ban on U.S. poultry because 4 years ago we had avian flu. Avian flu here in the United States, and we had a lot of chickens that we had to cull. And the Chinese, they put a ban on U.S. chicken. Well, that ban will probably be lifted if this problem with ASF continues to grow. They're going to need to fill that hole with some other animal protein or a combination of animal proteins, being beef, pork, and chicken, and so they would lift that ban. And so all of the proteins would probably benefit very well from what's going on in China right now. So anyway, that's kind of where we're at right now with ASF. Hopefully it doesn't come to the United States, and as long as it stays out of this country, we stand to benefit very well.
Is there a possible way, a possible chance that because of the amount of pork that China is going to be out now, that it could open the door for a more long-term U.S. beef export to China because of maybe taste change over time, or people don't trust the hog supply, or whatever it might be? Could that open a door that could be more more of a staple export of ours to China?
Well, that would be, if that would materialize, yeah, that would be wonderful for U.S. exporters and U.S. producers. It comes down to the Chinese, and what the Chinese consumer wants. Pork is their number one protein, their number one animal protein, and but that's competing now with chicken. Though chicken has become quite a bit more popular with the Chinese consumer. So if there's any protein that would appear to benefit a lot faster, it'd be chicken probably. Beef though would benefit as well. Poultry can respond faster to that demand, and there's evidence of the Chinese consumer liking poultry or chicken. And so, yeah, over long term, that may be the case. But one thing that the Chinese government is intent on is they want to make sure that they are food sufficient, especially with pork. So they're going to want to rebuild that pork or the swine herd as quickly as possible. It may take a few years to get back to where they were before, but they're going to rebuild that population. And they would rather import soybeans and grow the corn there in China and feed that to pigs and have a sustainable local pork supply for the Chinese consumer. Now, could they start importing poultry imports and beef imports from the United States? Could that become more of a staple? It's possible. But the Chinese government has shown in the past that they are very committed to making sure that the Chinese consumer has locally sourced animal protein, and they'll import grain to make up the balance. That's what they've done in the past. But
okay.
Perhaps things could change in the future.
I got you. Okay, so the idea that this could be just a long-term deal for the U.S. is probably, you're right, they do. They stockpile a lot of stuff, like their rice supplies and their corn supplies and their wheat supplies and stuff like that. They have decades worth of stuff on hand, you know what I mean? So it's just, it's a different mindset than what we're used to seeing over in the United States, for sure. Okay, so.
Yeah, well, they've got over a year's worth of supply of wheat, so they could have an entire crop failure in China and then some.
Right.
And they'll still be fine.
Yep.
And same likewise with corn and rice and cotton. I mean, they can withstand a little while without having to have any imports.
Okay. So let's talk about what you see, you know, with the things, with the economic conditions we see right now. To me, it feels like 2019 is, I'm very bullish about the end of the year, and I really feel like there's going to be a turning point here later in 2019. But it also feels like it's the toughest part of this downturn so far. I mean, equity positions have been chewed up. There's just guys that are struggling to scrape together enough to even go farm this year, even find lenders to lend them money to go to get operating nuts to go farm. So talk about what you see happening right now with the economic condition of the rural America in the farm economy and how you see that heading out towards the end of the year.
Well, like a lot of agricultural economists out there, I really don't have great news that things are going to be improving. But when you look at, I mean, it's pretty well talked about out there that, you know, we still have an abundance of agricultural commodities in the marketplace, both in the United States and in the world. We also have, as it remains, a very tenuous trade situation. So that's going to remain a depressing factor. Perhaps even if we get a deal inked with the Chinese, there's some questions of, like I mentioned earlier, will this trade uncertainty persist? Well, that's bad for the business climate. So having that hanging over the economy is not a good thing either. At the same time, we're starting to see an uptick in fertilizer prices. We're continually seeing the stressing of balance sheets with farmers and ranchers. We're seeing production expenses almost across the board going up. The bright side maybe this year for farmers and ranchers is that interest rates will probably not increase as much as they did in the past because the Fed is signaling that they won't increase rates this year any more than they did last year, that they're probably going to hold static where they're at. So the cost structure of agriculture is still elevated. The commodity price, the agricultural commodity basket is still depressed. And so really you've got to change one of these factors here. You've got to change, costs have to go down or cash receipts from higher commodity prices have to go up. And there's really no indication that either of those two things are going to happen. And so what's really keeping a lot of farmers hanging on right now is the strong value in their land that they're borrowing against. That's keeping a lot of farmers in business. But still, you're seeing Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies tick up every single year. They're not surging. They're just kind of gradually increasing. But one thing to keep in mind is that that doesn't account for farmers that are taking early retirement. There's okay. Still a lot of farmers out there that are financially stressed. Excuse me. And they're not prepared to declare bankruptcy, but instead they're just taking an early exit. And they're going to be renting out their farm ground and selling their machinery. And so that's kind of that. Those numbers are hard to find. You can't get really solid numbers on that. But that does mask some of what's going on when you look at farm bankruptcies that are very slow in their increase. Well, a lot of people are still leaving the industry without having to declare bankruptcy. Gotcha. So the outlook is that the commodities markets are still going to remain fairly soft. And it's going to really take a weather disaster somewhere in the world in order to cause a material change in commodity prices. So it's kind of, we're in this holding pattern that we've been in for the last few years, Casey. It's just we know the stress is there. We know the stress is persisting. We know there's a lot of farmers that are taking an early exit. But there's also a lot of farmers that came into the correction that were very financially solvent because they remembered back in the 1980s, and they knew not to make that mistake again by taking on a lot of debt at the peak of the market. And so it's just this kind of like a holding pattern. We're still just kind of it's just like a slow gradual building of financial stress. It's not, I would say if there's any one sector of the ag economy that is stressed more than anyone else, it would be the dairy sector. And we've seen a lot of dairies exit the industry, as evidenced with bankruptcies and herd numbers declining. But really, outside of dairy, it just remains a persistently stressful environment, but it's not like the 1980s. And there's really no sign yet that it will be. Now, everybody is looking at what's going on with land values versus net farm income and saying, well, when you have a 50% drop in net farm income from 2013 to today, there has to be some sort of correction in land values. And that hasn't happened. And everyone keeps saying eventually it will, but that's kind of the question on everyone's mind. When will land values correct? That is a really big unknown that has a lot of people scratching their heads and frankly concerned, because there's so much, so many farmers out there borrowing against their equity in their land. So the question really is, what's going to happen in that 3 to 5 year period, or even further out than that? That's the real question. That's when we could see perhaps something bigger happen with land values. It's just that when you look at right now, 2019, it doesn't look like we're going to see any serious change in direction from where we're at right now.
So that's been weighing on my mind. I've been talking about that for a while. When land prices switch and there's a flip or whatever there might be because of that, that's when you're going to start seeing this huge, with guys that are barely hanging on with the equity that they have in their land, and that's kind of their anchor. When they don't have that anchor anymore, man, that's going to cause a huge problem, just like you alluded to earlier. So what's your opinion of land prices, and do you see them being stable through this whole thing, or do you see there could be a possibility of a dip coming in that could cause something like this to happen?
Well, the land market is pretty regional, remember. Some areas of the country are experiencing more stress than others. And when you look at land values, especially in the Corn Belt, in the Northern Plains, or the Central Great Plains, that's where you're seeing land values soften over the past 5 years. Other areas of the country, they have not. They've actually gone up. So when you look at it in that way, you have to say, okay, let's, instead of looking at land values nationwide, let's look at where the stress is focused, and that's going to be the crop belt or the grain belt, where corn, wheat, and soybeans are grown. And so looking at from that view, we're going to have to see, I don't know, when can we see a drop in land values? I guess, honestly, Casey, if I had the answer to that question, I would own my own island and have my own yacht. I mean, you know the story.
Right.
I'm not that smart. I wish I was. But there's a lot of ag economists out there asking the same question. Nobody can really pinpoint it. No one can say, well, land values are going to drop 50% in the year 2022. There's nobody saying that, because this has been pretty perplexing so far with net farm income down so much already. And land values only being mildly lower, that already has people perplexed. But there's things that are different this time around than what happened in the 1980s. Number one, we have really, really, really cheap money. Interest rates, even though some people would argue that that since they're going up, that's been a stressor on farmers, and it has, historically, we still really have very, very cheap interest rates. Money is just not hard to find out there. You can get a loan from anybody almost. I was talking to one banker here recently, and he was saying in his town up in Washington State, the town of, I think, 2,500 people or 2,200 people, there were 6 banks.
Wow. Okay.
It's a lot of banks for a town that small. So interest rates are really cheap. It's a very competitive market, and so that has saved a lot of farmers. And also, the nature of farming has changed, or the size of farms have changed. Farms today are much, much bigger. They're much more efficient. They're better managed. you know, they're under better management, typically anyway, compared to what, you know, when you have many decades of consolidation, you're going to have more deficiency in management. And so that's changed. So when you add up all these things that are different, it's hard to say, okay, well, let's find an analog industry or an analog year where we can say, okay, after X number of years, when the industry has become more consolidated and more efficient, then we can see the correction tail off in 10 years. There's really nothing to look at as an analog year or an analog industry, you know. Yeah, things are just different this time around. Farming is different. The nature of farming is different. The interest rates are different. It's really hard to say because this is such a new territory. Now, in hindsight, when we look back, we're all going to say, well, of course we saw that coming. I'm so smart. I could have told you exactly what's going to happen when the correction of land markets was going to happen in this year. But looking forward, it's really hard to do.
Right.
It's really hard to pinpoint where that's going to happen. If you want me to put a date on when land prices are going to drop 50% or whatever, I can't do it.
I don't want that. Because if you know, me and you just need to keep it a secret between the two of us.
That's right. Yeah, it's just an impossible thing to engage. I mean, we can try to look at what's going on globally with other markets, but really, it's just really, really hard to pinpoint that.
Yeah. No, that is difficult, but. You know, when everything was going on, we had the, you know, huge $8 corn and different stuff like that. It seemed like prices were driven, obviously, by commodity prices, but also by speculators, too, were buying land to speculate and to try to make a profit on. Do you see much of that still happening?
Yeah, there are institutional investors out there. A good friend of mine, as a matter of fact, he works for a fund that he specializes in agricultural land, and he's on the hunt, and he'll tell you it's really hard to find good quality farm ground that's going to get the capitalization rates, the cap rates that you're looking for. But just to put this into context, cap rates on farmland, which is a cap rate, is when you take the rental value divided by the value of the land. So if you just make the math really, really easy here, let's say you buy a piece of ground for $1,000 an acre and you rent it out at $30 an acre. Well, your capitalization rate is 30 divided by 1,000. That's 3%.
Okay.
Well, if you want 3% on your money, look at the 10-year bond.
Right. Yeah.
That's risk-free.
Right.
And you get some tax benefits from it also. What's the point of buying farmland in Iowa with a 3% cap rate when all you have to do is just go buy a bond?
Yeah.
So when you've got that competitive pressure, there are a lot of people a lot of outside investors who said, you know, this just isn't worth my risk. I mean, farming is high-risk business. You got weather, you got politics, you got trade, you've got regulation, you got to deal with land or tenants, and you never know what you're going to get there. Why do I need to have that headache for 3%?
Right.
I can still buy a bond and get 3% there.
Yep.
So there's a lot. There are outside investors who have become tired of trying to find a good quality farm ground. My friend who runs a fund, he tells me no far more than he ever says yes. It's just hard to find a good investment in farm ground.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're a farmer and you're not looking at cap rates, you're just looking at dollars per acre return. Well, that's a different story. Farmers are kind of coming at it from a different angle. And if they're looking at farming for multiple generations, they'll take that risk on that piece of ground that comes up across the road. Of course, they'll pay any price almost. There's a piece of ground that's just down the road from the farm, yeah. So, you know, that element is always going to be there. But as for outside investors, you know, there's always going to be those outside investors that are looking to diversify their portfolios, but there just aren't a lot of outside investors clamoring to get into farm ground.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of people just dying to do it. Yeah. Because you've got other options. Well, they're much safer options, like buying a bond. Why buy land? Why just buy a bond?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that is true. That is very true. So this is why I like having you on here, man, because you shoot it straight, but you also, you don't make it boring. So that's one of the reasons why I like having you on here. But so you're looking at, you're keeping it real, bro. I like it. You have, let's take a look at what's going on in the rest of the world now. So there's a epic drought going on over in, Australia. They had some drought issues last year in Ukraine, southern Russia, the Black Sea region. When it comes to wheat production, those are the two biggest areas that really have a lot of wheat production. And then what you see happening down in South America right now, they're kind of on again, off again with dryness right now. I think they're in pretty good shape. But,
yeah,
I mean, overall global economy, it looks like to me that we're going to have a lot of grain back on the market. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, those are the numbers that I'm hearing from other people, or the numbers would point to that we're going to see a continuation of ample supplies globally in the grain markets, ample supplies in animal protein. And, when you've got such a saturated market globally, it's really hard to paint a bullish picture for agriculture here in the U.S. Other parts of the world are going to do a lot better than the U.S. Because even though they're all dealing with similar commodity prices or the same facts that we just talked about of an abundance of supply, some countries are dramatically different in their economics and so therefore are going to be motivated to continue to produce and export. Let's talk, for instance, down in Brazil. They've got a much cheaper currency than the United States. And, if they continue to have political problems down there and problems with corruption and with their economy, that's going to be weak on the currency. And so, therefore, that's bullish on their commodities because commodities globally are traded in dollars. And if the U.S. economy remains strong and their economy is weak, that means their currency is going to drop in value. So they're going to take that cheap currency that they sold their grain for, turn around, and get dollars, and they're going to get paid a lot of money because the dollar is so strong compared to their local currency. So the incentive there is to expand acreage. Same thing, not just in South America, but go over to the former Soviet Union. You just mentioned wheat production there a little bit ago. Same thing there. When you've got weakness in, say, the Russian ruble, well, that's going to incentivize Russian farmers to expand production. Well, right now, the hope here is that with strong oil prices, that is going to raise the value of the Russian ruble because the Russian is a petrostate. Because their economy is so dependent on oil and natural gas, their currency is tracks very closely to the price of oil. So here recently we had the price of oil go up. And so if this remains so, if oil remains at elevated levels and the Russian ruble remains strong, that's going to disincentivize farmers from expanding acreage. That's going to tell them, because they're going to get paid less, that's going to cause them to perhaps reduce acreage or maybe put on less fertilizer and not be so ambitious in their yields. And so potentially that might be a positive. Because of the strong oil price, that would translate to a strong ruble, and that might decrease grain production in that part of the world. We're really trying to squeeze the water out of a rock here, trying to find good news for U.S. ag producers. especially for wheat producers. But that is a possibility longer term. Right. We might be able to pick up some export markets overseas if we do see a reduction in Russian wheat production. And same with Ukraine. That whole area over there is very competitive on wheat. So, yeah, globally, we're still dealing with abundant supplies, and it's just really hard to paint a bullish picture when you've got those fundamentals.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, a ton of stuff going on, man. There's always, I love talking with you, Tanner. It's a great thing, especially with a fellow Kansan on here. I enjoy that as much as anybody does. So Tanner, if folks want to reach out to you and ask you questions, how would they do that?
Well, they can always go to the PhilBank website, philbank.com, and Knowledge Exchange is is the name of our research department, and you can reach me through our website, or you can send me an email. It's THMKE at philbank.com.
Right on. And also, make sure you check out what's your Twitter handle?
Tanner Emke.
Tanner Emke, there you go. Easy enough. So check out Tanner on Twitter. He's got some good stuff. He posts good stuff out there. So, Tanner, as always, man, thanks for being a guest on the podcast, and I look forward to talking to you again, man.
Thanks a lot, Casey. Good to be back. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Moving Iron Podcast, now part of the Global Ag Network. If you'd like to continue any of these conversations, you can hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Moving Iron LLC. You can also send me an email at Moving Iron Podcast at movingironpodcast.com. You can also visit the Moving Iron Podcast YouTube channel and watch Market Roundup with Chip Nellinger, Sean Hackett, and Angie Setzer. Also, Tax News with Glenn Birnbaum. Please visit movingironllc.com. Here you can find information, details, and updates for the 2019 Moving Iron Summit in Nashville, Tennessee. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can leave a review and subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, and globalagnetwork.com. So until next time, let's go move some iron. This is Casey Seymour. Out.
Moving iron in the 21st century. Hardworking people working hard for you and me. Moving iron time and time again. Through the years you'll find the sea.